international corporations.
All right. Thank you, Casey Neal. This is Roger Wendell. This is Connections. The time is 8:31, and it is the 14th of May, 2021. And today my guest will be joining us by phone, Doug Peacock. He's the author of a number of books, including Grizzly Years, Walking It Off, and Wilderness and the Essential Grizzly, which he co-wrote with Andrea Peacock. Doug served 2 years of duty in Vietnam and was awarded 3 different military honors, one of which was the Bronze Star. Doug and Edward Abbey were close friends, with the main character in Abbey's The Monkey Wrench Gang, Hey Duke, based on Doug himself. Doug Peacock is founder and board chair for Save the Yellowstone Grizzly. The organization was formed in 2016 in response to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service proposal to remove grizzly bears from their threatened status in Yellowstone. Doug Peacock, good morning. Welcome to KGNU.
Thank you, Roger.
Good to have you here. So we're going to talk about the environment, Edward Abbey, grizzly bears, and all things related, but I wanted to start off with a little bit of a tangent here this morning that caught my attention, and that is, while a young guy at the University of Michigan, you worked on getting Martin Luther King to speak on campus. How did that come about?
Well, back when I was 20 years old, I was head of a committee at the Michigan Union, and I had some funding for speakers, and so this is something I did pretty much by myself, and I invited Martin Luther King to come down and got him an honorarium and got him a plane, and I had a lot of resistance from one of the dean at the College of Engineering at the University of Michigan was a John Birch. And he sat me down and subjected me to all this incredible hate literature about Martin Luther King. And the FBI was, you know, instrumental in gathering this information. So it wasn't just a walk in the park. But, you know, I think for 20 years old, bringing Martin Luther King to the University of Michigan, that's pretty good for an ignorant young Midwestern guy.
Yeah, it's
and,
pretty.
You know, I'm just proud of that. I got to pick him up to airport and have dinners with him, and it just being around that great man was such an honor, and I'm really proud of that early event in my life. It kind of paved the way for the rest of it, actually.
Yeah, that is really cool. I was impressed with that, and I'm glad you're able to share it with us. But back around those days, too, you know, the Vietnam War was raging, and you got caught up in it. And I know it was traumatic, and you talked about it in your book. I read Walking It Off here recently, really enjoyed the book. But I know it was a lot of trauma. Would you care to talk about your Vietnam experience at all and maybe fill some of the younger folks in as to what it was like then? You talked about Martin Luther King not being welcomed by some of the staff at the university. Kind of the general environment, and then your involvement in the Vietnam War for 2 tours of duty.
Yeah, it. I was there at the University of Michigan when it was sort of in the early '60s, it was the beginning of the New Left. I did not love college. What I loved was the Rocky Mountains, so I quit every other semester and, you know, come out here, come out to Arizona, Colorado. I'm in Montana now, but I love the entire span of the Rocky Mountains. And pound nails for a living. And in those days, if you didn't have a child or weren't married, you got drafted to Vietnam. So you had to get your butt back in school about every 6 months at least. And eventually the draft caught up with me, and I wasn't going to go to Canada. And I had been active in the anti-war movement in Southeast Asia. But I didn't know much about Vietnam. What I knew about was Laos. But it is a measure of kind of a perversity in my own life. I have to go see for myself all the bloody time. And back in the mid-60s, I thought I'd just go over there and put my 3 years in and and be done with it. And of course, I was drastically mistaken. You know, the Vietnam, and I loved being over there. I loved the land and the people up in the Central Highlands. And I worked with indigenous people all day long, ethnic mountaineer people mostly, that spoke a Hmong Kapir language, more Cambodian than me. But I also spoke Vietnamese. And every day there, I saw the war through the indigenous people. Sometimes I'd go a whole day in Vietnam without speaking a word of English until I got back to my A-team at night. So it was a different point of view. By the time the Tet Offensive rolled around, everybody knew the Tet Offensive was coming except our military. And it was crazy. And I ended up in a hospital, and the mobile guerrilla team that I was the junior medic on got overrun by Russian tanks up by the DMZ in February of 1968. And it was just a crazy time, a murderous time, when one government leaves and another government moves into a village or a city. And, you know, in between that space, everybody tends to collect their justice and their revenge for everything else. And it was since I was a senior medic on the scene and there wasn't another one around, I was in a village on Quang Nga province, which is, you know, in the Central Highlands of Vietnam. And the chaos that followed the Tet Offensive, 79 civilians got killed or injured in my little village, which was only like, 2,000 people. And I just handled too many dead and wounded children. And I had to get out then. And as I was flying out of Vietnam, I flew over My Lai.
Oh, yeah.
When the massacre was happening, we got shot at, which is no big deal. I flew out in a helicopter from my A camp to the South China Sea, and we got shot at, and I looked down, and I'd been on the ground there. I knew it was My Lai, but I didn't know what happened there until those pictures in Life magazine came out over a year later. And those pictures changed my life.
Yeah, these were huge events, the My Lai massacre and, of course, the Tet Offensive. And there you were involved in all of that. And I'm just kind of curious, and I promise we're going to talk about grizzlies. It's so fascinating, the work you're doing up in Yellowstone and some of the other related things.
Mm-hmm.
But do you bristle, or did you, as a Vietnam vet, you saw some really horrendous stuff. Did you bristle during the Gulf Wars, or even now, do you, the hair stand up on the back of your neck when you hear about maybe Russia lining up on the Ukrainian border, or China and the U.S. not getting along, or, even Israel? I guess we're lobbing missiles back and forth in Israel as I speak. How do you take that as a vet that's seen the worst of it?
I think this is a commonality of traumatized war veterans, especially from Vietnam. But every kind of encounter just dredges up the ghost of your own combat past. And, I imagine myself in almost, all through these very bad wars, that are not just, they're not winnable, and the combat soldiers in those events, some of them know that all the way along, and I basically lived the experience, there's nothing worse than than being in an artillery or barrage. It's cool fate. One of them the one that gets you won't get to somebody else, and vice versa. And it dredges up all the ghost. And it's not only my experience. It's experience. I've got friends live the same way. And just vicariously by watching the news, it takes them right back there. And, you know, it's a healthy thing, but it takes a lot of energy and dredges up a lot of ghost. And that's no picnic.
Well, I appreciate you talking about it. I mean, you know, huge trauma in your life and that of others, and, you know, especially the civilians you've described. So you left the war, and you were affected by this, but I've seen all over the internet and in your books about you talking about having to walk it off, your experience in wilderness. Tell us about that. Wilderness kind of as therapy for not only this, you know, war wounds, but maybe anything else.
Yeah, when I came back from Vietnam, like innumerable other veterans, I wasn't any good around people, not even my own family. I couldn't talk to anybody. So I bought a Jeep and drove west to, you know, west to, in the early spring to the Rocky Mountains. And I moved north as the snows melted, and I finally... The one place that I was comfortable, and I've always been comfortable, is the wilderness. You know, I camp out by myself. I walk sometimes a couple hundred miles by myself, and that's my home. And it was that way when I came back from Vietnam. I, you know, eventually moved my way up the Rocky Mountains, into the Wind River Range on the east side, which is a wild, wild place. It's a place. I had a little road map of the Northern Rocky Mountains I carried to Vietnam with me, and I kept looking. You know, I'd look at this map, and I'd look at the blank spots on the map, you know, up around Yellowstone and Glacier and the Wind Rivers, and I'd wonder what was in them. So when I got back, that's exactly where I had it. And up in the Wind River Range, by summertime, I came down with a malaria attack, which is, you know, I'm no stranger to. I've had malaria half a dozen. I maybe have had four reinfections of malaria. You know, I went back to Vietnam in 2011. I got malaria again. So, but I had to get out of the Wind Rivers, which are rugged and the weather's terrible. And I decided I'd go into Yellowstone. Because I'd spent some time in Yellowstone, and I was going to go into a place with hot springs and soak in hot creeks and kind of regain my health. Anyway, that's what I imagined for myself. And I ran into grizzly bears. I wasn't looking for them, but they were there. And once they're there, you have to pay attention. And that was the beginning of a relationship that has gone on for 50 years. It's, you know, that's one thing I do full time, is I do my best to protect grizzly bears who are still listed on the Endangered Species Act today as threatened species. But that was, and I also love the deserts, the low deserts. When the grizzly bears hibernate, I like to hightail it down towards Mexico. And just before my, you know, before my children were born, I would take long, long hikes around the holidays, you know, that take 10 days and just go out by myself in the country where if you didn't know where the water was or didn't find it, you know, you really died. So, but I love that country. And that has been the, you know, the polar balance of my life. I'm more a nomad than I do have a strong homing instinct. You know, I like to hang out with the grizzlies, and when they hibernate, I like to go down to the incredible low desert.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about the grizzlies at length. So much work you've done in that regard and protections and the environment. But I wonder if we could back up again a little bit and talk about one of my favorite writers, and you're one of them, but Edward Abbey. How did you meet Ed Abbey? How close was your friendship? How did that all unfold?
Well, I ran into Ed Abbey in the winter of the first year when I came home from Vietnam. I was down in Tucson in the wintertime, and I had a close friend who was a well-known writer. It was William Eastlake. And I just happened to, you know, be a buddy of this guy, and he invited me over to his house one night. And back then, I had a job as a substitute mailman, and I rode a motorcycle. And it was wintertime, and I went over to where his house was, which is on the outskirts of Tucson. And back then, it was way out lonely. So I drove my motorcycle around for, you know, in December of 1968, for half an hour looking for his ranch or house way out in the desert. And I finally found a place. And I went in, and there were some people sitting around, writer types mostly. And I took a seat by this guy with a black beard. And in those days, I smoked cigarettes, but I rolled my own, you know. So I took out a little Ziploc of Bugler tobacco and started to roll, you know, a joint-like cigarette. And but I couldn't light it because my hands were shaking from the cold. And this guy reached across with a lighter and gave me a light, Edward Abbey. And that was the beginning of a 20-year-old cantankerous, but really close friendship. Ed and I, you know, we camped out a lot. Our best times, although we saw each other, you know, we were close friends for 20 years. And I was with him when he died, and I buried him. And, you know, it was a cantankerous friendship. I was more like the fictional character of George Hayduke then, and Ed was no prince himself. But I loved him. And we shared, the most important thing we shared was our belief in wilderness and the need to defend it. All those years I've worked, I was a grizzly advocate from the very beginning, and I spent about 15 years seasonally, but full-time seasonally, filming grizzlies in and around Glacier and Yellowstone National Parks. And I'd go back and live in the wilderness for usually periods of time that averaged about 10 days, sometimes 2 weeks. But I'd go in and set up a camp, and where the grizzly bears would come through, or else I'd wander around looking for grizzly sign. And then if there's snow in the ground, I'd track them to where, you know, sometimes it took a couple of days to run them down. And eventually, I was a lot of, you know, I could buy myself on the national news programs in those days because I had a lot of rare, wild grizzly footage. You know, I never filmed grizzlies around roads or other people. I always filmed them in the wilderness. And eventually, there was a film made about me called Peacock Swarm that premiered on the nature slot of PBS. And, after I bugged the grizzlies for 15 years, I decided I was going to leave them alone. So since then, that was the end of my cinematography years.
This is so interesting. I want to get into the grizzlies, I promise, in detail. But
if I wander a little bit, anchor me down.
This is good.
You know, Ed Abbey. I mean, there's one place that I used to film grizzly bears up near Glacier, I called the Grizzly Hill. And for instance, Peter Matheson was also a close friend of mine.
Did he do the snow leopard? Maybe I'm getting confused here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Leopard. He won the National Book Award for both fiction and nonfiction.
Yes. Yeah. A wonderful read. Like all of this.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, Peter was. I love Peter too, and I took him to Grizzly Hill. Peter and I saw 25 grizzlies in a single day. Well, I took Ed Abbey up there, and we didn't see any. He's the only person I've taken to this particular place. It's crawling with bears. They didn't see one. And to the end of his days, Ed Abbey would call the grizzly the alleged grizz. Because
the alleged.
He went down rivers in Alaska and just never saw the grizz. So,
hey, I want to brag just for a brief moment, and it's not much of a brag, but I was a young pimply-faced kid, and I was able to meet with Ed privately to conduct business. You know, I admired his, read all of the books and everything, and I had this opportunity, what I considered once in a lifetime, to meet with him personally, privately for business. But what struck me, he was very cordial. He knew what he was dealing with. You know, a starstruck kid. But I was shocked at how quiet he was. And if those, you know, in the listening audience that are familiar with his writings, he seems, you know, rambunctious, opinionated, all that. But, you know, my brief meeting with him, he seemed quiet. Was that him normally, or maybe it was because it was near the end of his life? I know he was contemplating cancer and that kind, or not cancer, rather, but esophageal issues. Privately, was he a quiet guy, in your opinion? Or,
yeah, if Ed didn't have anything to say, he would keep quiet. And, as in contrast to his explosive prose in something like Desert Solitaire or the Monkey Wrench Gang, he was quiet. You know, that's accurate. And, he was a good public speaker.
Yeah. He spoke here at the Denver Public Library speakers series, I think in the 1986. I don't remember when it was exactly. And I went there and saw him there. And, I asked him at the time, I said, he was taking questions from the audience. This was a different meeting. And there was 900 people there, the most people they ever had at the Denver Public Library. And I asked him, publicly, what do you think of Two Forks Dam, which was just a raging issue back here? And he said, he scratched his goatee or his little beard, and he said, I never heard of Two Forks Dam, but if it's a dam, I'm against it. The crowd exploded, and his answer made it into the Denver Post, the local paper here, the next day. So he was, very charismatic and, just wonderful. But I wonder if you could talk about your portrayal in the Monkey Wrench Gang as George Washington Hayduke. I know you've tried to distance yourself from that at times over the years. I've watched that. And it's kind of reminiscent of Leonard Nimoy, rather, who wrote a book called I Am Not Spock. So I'm wondering if there's going to be a Peacock book, I Am Not Hayduke.
Yeah, I dressed it a little bit and Walking It Off and our memoirs. I'm having a little trouble with this phone. I'm sorry if I make noises.
It's clicking a little bit. That's okay. Just as long as you continue to stand on top of the refrigerator or wherever the reception's best.
Okay, I'll keep as quiet as possible.
No, that's okay. That part's okay. We just don't want to lose you.
Okay. Ed Abbey, the hero of the Monkey Wrench Gang, is a fictional character that Ed created called George Washington Hayduke, who was a Green Beret medic and physically in other ways resembled the real-life Peacock. But Hayduke was in large part Edward Abbey, and only Ed Abbey would know the exact threads that came together to create that character. And, on the other hand, it was sort of, the book was,
Oops, we may have lost you there. You're saying the book was what? We lost you right there.
Okay, my phone is a little haywire. Excuse me, I need a drink. Okay. Excuse me, I just lost connection.
Well, that's okay. Let's take a moment here. The time is 8:56. You're listening to Connections. I'm Roger Wendell, and my guest joining us by phone from Yellowstone National Park or that nearby vicinity is Doug Peacock, and he's the author of Grizzly Years, In Search of the American Wilderness, also wrote Walking It Off, A Veteran's Chronicle of War and Wilderness, and he wrote The Essential Grizzly, the Mingled Fates of Men and Bears, which he co-wrote with Andrea Peacock. And we're going to open up the phone lines here in just a bit. Donna's standing by with all the technical stuff and the phones, and you can reach us at 303-442-4242. Again, if you want to join the conversation, you have any questions for Doug Peacock, we're at 303-442-4242. And this is KGNU Boulder, Denver, and Fort Collins. So, Doug, back to you. We're losing the connection. Are you hearing us okay?
You know, the character of Hayduk was, in a lowbrow sense, kind of famous. It was written on bathroom walls, you know, Hayduk lives. And so it's glitzy. And, of course, the temptation, it's seductive to have a character, you know, a relatively, if regional, famous character based on you. But, you know, there's nothing worse than being someone else's fiction. And I was fortunate because I had my own life by the time The Monkey Wrench Gang was published. I was filming Grizzlies full time, and I was, you know, a known defender of wilderness, especially the wilderness that contained the grizzlies. But it is Hayduk Lives bumper stickers are not rare in the American West.
Yep, that's for sure. I still see them.
I'm what earthly is left of George Washington Hayduk, and I'm okay with that. On the other hand, when I buried Ed, I buried most of Hayduk. That's the way I deeply feel about it.
And fair enough. Hey, let's take a moment and talk about the burial. Apparently in a secret grave in the Cabeza Prieta Wilderness in Arizona. Paint the burial scene for us.
Well, the last time Ed smiled was on the last night of his life. I was taking the watch. You know, he died at his house in Tucson, Arizona, and it was my watch that night. And the last time he smiled was when I named the mountain range in which I intended to bury him. And so, just as the sun was coming up, Ed left us. And we packed him in a sleeping bag, threw him in the back of a pickup, and drove, you know, deep into the night as far west as we could get, and spent the next 2 days finding and preparing a burial site way out in the wilderness. And on March the 16th, 1989, we all helped dig the grave, and we planted Ed Abbey. And incidentally, March 16th, which is the date that he was stuck in the ground, he actually died 2 days earlier, is also the date of the My Lai massacre. For me, that's a very big deal. And March 16th is my Day of the Dead. And about, you know, it's been a long time, 89, you know, that's a lot of years. And about half those years, on the March 16th, I go out there with grave offerings and some Mexican beer, which I pour over the grave. And then, you know, I visit old Ed. It's a kind of a sacred place for me. It's a place where I hold my own ceremonies and mourn my dead.
No, I can appreciate that. But it brings to mind a question, and I don't recall the author's name, but he wrote a book through the University of Arizona Press where he had a photograph of the gravestone, and I think the gravestone says something like "No comment at Abbey," and it gives his years.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's kind of a secret place, how did this photograph end up in some guy's book?
Maybe you have
no idea what I'm talking about, but
no, I have an idea. The guy came and interviewed me, and it took him a couple of years to find the grave. And basically, I'm the one that gave it away, you know. But it's not a place you can get to very easy, and not very many people that Clark.
Whoops, we may have lost you there. You still hearing me?
Yeah, I am.
Okay. You mentioned Clark Abbey. That's his wife, Ed's wife.
His widow. Uh-huh.
Yep.
And, you know, Clark has taken the family members. Last time I was out there, I took Ed's youngest son. And when we had a friend die, Doug Tompkins, who was a famous mountaineer. He started North Face and Esprit, and he drowned with my friend Rick. I'm having a lot of trouble with my phone. I apologize.
Well, what we could do, if you want, we could pause and have you redial in. We're hearing you okay. We're just getting some clicks, and I think we can endure that.
Okay, it's a ding on my side. But anyway, let me just try to keep my face away from this phone, and it'll work a little better. Rick Ridgway, and who's the first American on K2, for instance, but he's a very close friend of mine. And we had a wake for Doug out by Ed's grave, you know, and it was really I've written a book, another book going to be published by Patagonia Press in October of this year. And it's called "Was It Worth It?" And I talk about Doug and Doug Tompkins and Yvon Chouinard and Tom Brokaw and Rick Ridgway. We all went over to the Russian Far East to track the Siberian tiger together, and Doug Tompkins was with us then, and Doug and Rick were sharing a double kayak down in Chile on a freshwater lake. Wind blew up. They dumped in the middle of the lake. Rick, who was younger, lived, and Doug died of hypothermia. So that's where we held our wake, at Ed's grave. It has that connotation for me. So I would I don't want anybody going out and desecrating the grave, and those guys did find it, but that was
right.
They looked for it for a couple of years. And if anybody betrayed the burial site, it was Doug Peacock, I'm afraid.
Okay.
Because there's just too many hints if you know the country.
I wonder if we could provide I'm not being critical. I admire what you did. I think you did a good thing, but maybe a cautionary note for listeners. I know from the Park Service and other places, you can't indiscriminately deposit ashes or even bodies on public land. So don't do this with grandma this weekend, please.
Well, that's okay. But in the spirit of Ed Abbey, it was quite an illegal burial, you know, transporting a dead body onto public lands where it's illegal to bury anybody, but we did it anyway. And, Ed was an advocate of civil disobedience. And there are times in any adults, what's legal is not always right, and vice versa. And I offer no apologies, but you're quite right. It was an illegal act. And,
yeah, no, I'm not. It's not an indictment or anything. I'm just anybody listening who's planning to take Grandma to Rocky Mountain National Park this weekend. I recommend you don't do it.
Well, and make sure you don't get caught.
Yeah, or don't get caught. Okay, 9:06 is the time. You're listening to Connections. My guest this morning is Doug Peacock, and we're talking about grizzly bears and all the books he's written. His relationship with Edward Abbey. We do have an open line if you want to call in. If you have any questions, want to participate, it's 303-442-4242. Again, 303-442-4242. So, Doug, let's talk about Grizzlies. A lot of interesting statements from you over the years about Grizzly behavior. And one of the things that fascinates me is that you've mentioned a number of times that you were charged by grizzly bears at least 20 times and survived it and weren't even attacked. What's that all about? Why would a grizzly bear charge you? And why wouldn't a grizzly bear kill you like we so often hear in the news, or maybe we think we so often hear?
Well, the vast majority, and I mean 90+% of grizzly bears towards humans are mother grizzlies protecting their young, their cubs of the year or their yearlings, even two-year-olds sometimes. Grizzly bears, keep their young with them at least 2 years on the average. And so the secret, if there is any secret, and it's not a secret, of getting along with grizzly bears is do not be a threat to a mother's cubs. To their young, and a mother grizzly, if you stumble upon one at close range, and grizzly bears, in the summertime they bed out the middle of hot days, and you can get really close to them by accident, and that's a bad situation because the mother will almost reflexively charge what she perceives as a threat to her cub. But the opposite is also true. If you're not a threat to their young, no bear has ever touched me. And I've had a couple bears charge and skid to a stop. One mother actually leaned forward. She was about 4 feet away and appeared to sniff my pant leg. But what I do, and is I don't do anything. I don't move. I don't look at the bear. A frontal orientation with a grizzly bear is confrontational. And I don't scream. I might talk softly to the mother at the last moment just to let her know what I am. But I don't move. And I don't look her straight in the face. And, it's so far so good, I guess.
What about this idea? I think I've seen this a few times up in Montana. People in the backcountry, in the woods, the forest, carrying maybe a sidearm or a firearm. Is that a good idea in grizzly country? And I know it sounds like a naive question, but does it embolden you if you're carrying a sidearm?
It might embolden you, and that's a bad thing. You don't want to be emboldened. You want to be humble. Above all, grizzlies instill a sense of humility in human beings. That's a good, humility is a good posture, I think, for human beings because it opens it up and we listen. It is the emotional posture behind reason. But carrying a gun, if you were to wound a grizzly, a mother grizzly, say, you face a mother grizzly and she's maybe 50 or 100 feet away. If you scream at that bear, you might get charged and mauled. If you try to run, she will run you down. Never try to climb a tree because grizzlies are just too fast. They've gone up trees 22 feet and dragged a human being out of them. So, they're not supposed to climb trees, but their momentum can send them way up the side of one. But carrying a gun is a terrible idea, especially if you wound a mother grizzly. That grizzly, first of all, it's going to take care of you in a violent way, and it's going to be a danger to anybody else in the area too. But it seems to me, to be a simple thing. People who have actually gotten hit by a grizzly that was, they maybe just their instinct was to jerk and try to run. They got nailed by the grizzly. Okay, if you know that advice to play dead actually worked with a mother grizzly. They, you know, if you don't resist, you get out of it. A bunch of young girls up where I live in Montana had that situation, and one of the grizzly mother actually had her paw rested on a girl, and she just somehow found the inner strength to be passive and relax and play dead, and the bear just walked away, left her alone.
Yeah, I certainly want to talk about climate change and the effect it has on bears and your work with preventing the delisting of the grizzly, but I'm still kind of interested in this, you know, human encounter aspect of it all. What do you think of a $40 can of bear repellent spray from REI? Is that something to carry around, or is that equally useless?
I never carry it during the daytime. You know, you might sleep a little better at a tent if you got a can of that stuff laying around. But you know, I'm sorry, but it sounds to me the parks, but it's got, you know, it's got shares in the bear spray business. But I've got two examples where spraying a bear made it more aggressive. And during the day, because of my experience with probably 30 grizzlies, I know I can safely get out of any daytime encounter with a grizzly bear by just being calm and presenting no threat to the bear. And if you spray that bear, a bear who would otherwise might go away someday is going to turn around and fatally maul somebody, and then you'll have lawsuits all over the place. But, you know, I leave if you feel safer carrying a can of that stuff around, it's okay, but it shouldn't be mandatory. I don't think it's even wise. I mean, personally, I would never use a can of bear spray during the daytime, ever.
What about your response to the old joke, you know, finding little sets of bells in bear scat? What about the bells?
Yeah. Well, I consider them an obscenity in grizzly country. You know, when I go, and I'm in grizzly country all the time, I don't make any noise, you know, and I consider screaming hey bear and jingling bear bells really an obscenity in the wilderness. We don't need all that racket. If you're not comfortable going in the wilderness without them, just don't go. I'm sort of hard on that point.
But. You know, kind of a tangent, it just came to mind. I do a little bit of hiking, well, quite a bit when I can. I notice lately a lot of people are playing music in the backcountry without earbuds. They're playing, and I, you know, I've never taken the time to ask them why they're doing that, other than they obviously enjoy the music. But I'm wondering if they're playing music to scare bears away, or... But it does seem very intrusive to me. Here you're in this wonderful wilderness area like Indian Peaks or whatever we have around here, and you know, you're listening to Blink 182 on the trail.
I can't imagine. Look, at we need to have, I mean, the use of a wild, nobody gives advice on that. The government doesn't want us to use the wild. They don't want us interacting with grizzlies. And but to go into, you know, a so-called wild area, whether it's official wilderness or not, and carry all our, you know, in all our toys with us, I just feel is utterly inappropriate. And you know, you don't need to pollute the wilderness with your noises. For Christ's sake, you know, that's one of the great beauties of nature is you know, the lack of intrusive human sounds. And I consider it very bad manners to go in there with a firearm. Just if things don't go right for the human being, you know, you blow the bear away. And I feel the same way about playing music and screaming hey bear all the time from the trails.
So, you know, we had an incident here. You probably wouldn't have heard of it, but 2 weeks ago, I think it was a 39-year-old woman was killed by a bear here in Colorado. Now, It's my understanding the last grizzly bear was killed in Colorado probably 80 years ago, so this would have been a brown or a black bear. But is the behavior of these other species of bears similar to the grizzly?
Yeah, well, it's not similar. It's a different species with a total behavioral. Black bear are really not a threat. You can run a black bear off a trail, even if it's got cubs with them, and, you know, you don't hurt them, but they'll back off. And the last grizzly was killed up at towards Blue Lake down in the South San Juan in 1979. And there were some grizzlies left. And I founded Round River Conservation Studies in 1991. And we had students in the South San Juan for most of a decade looking for grizzlies and collecting scat and whatnot. It never panned out. On the other hand, the proof of a last grizzly in Colorado would be a dead bear, and we didn't find any of those either. So every now and then you hear a rumor, but I think the last grizzly was probably in the Chalk Mountains way down by New Mexico. And I looked for it for, you know, a number of years myself, first with a citizen search that Bruce Basil he's in Durango now, but Bruce Basil and I started that. And then later with Round River Conservation Studies, we had students in there, you know, for the summer. So, you know, it's been pursued, but the bear that killed the woman would have been a black bear. And they actually do, you know, I don't know anything about this particular mauling, but there's a rare but predaceous pattern to young male black bears, and often their prey seems to be human beings not fully grown. It's really kind of scary, but it's utterly rare, too. And they actually kill more people than grizzly bears do. Of course, they're everywhere. They're pretty much anywhere it's not plowed or paved, you can find black bear habitat.
Yeah, apparently they hunted down this bear. I guess it's a black bear. I'll go with that. And they killed it. You know, that's usually the response we have here in Colorado. Your thoughts on killing a bear that's attacked somebody as opposed to maybe relocating them?
Well, I think I utterly believe that, you know, you need to examine it case by case. When a bear is defensive, you know, it's a mother defending cubs, or even, you know, in the spring, sometimes a male grizzly will be on a carcass. And a guy got mauled not too far from where I live a couple months ago, and the grizzly bear was defending a moose carcass. They should have left that grizzly bear alone, because that's normal behavior. Most of the time, defending a carcass when the food sources are very thin, which is true in the middle of the summer and also the early spring. And any defense of a mother for her young, there's no need to remove those bears. And there is absolutely zero evidence that, you know, anybody that a bear mauling a human learns to like mauling humans. There's zero evidence of that in the world, and most of the retaliation against bears who injure somebody is a cultural insecurity of our own culture, not bear behavior.
So 9:20 is the time. You're listening to Connections. Doug Peacock is my guest. He's probably one of the foremost experts on grizzly bears. And we're going to continue talking about that. I wanted to ask you about climate change and the work you did in 2016 to protect the Yellowstone grizzly, but a thought came to my mind when you talk about this cultural aspect and people interacting with bears. I think his name was Timothy Treadwell. Does that sound right, up in Alaska? Any comments on that?
Well, Timothy was a young man who had cameras or video cameras and went up every summer to the south coastal shore of Katmai National Monument, where there's salmon runs. And he spent been about 10 years going up there and filming grizzlies and himself with the grizzly. You know, when this has happened anyway, the grizzly bears, their mutual antagonism breaks down. And they transfer that holistically to human beings. So Timothy could get very close. Well, he came to me. I was in Tucson after the first year he got started, probably get some kind of approval. And I did warning of a couple bad situations. But he had so much experience with those, you know, they're wild bears, but they appear almost tame when there's a lot of salmon around. You've all seen the picture, so you know what I mean. A grizzly bear up in British Columbia, the mother came over and left her three cubs sitting right next to me on a salmon stream, went out and got a salmon and came back and collected her cubs and just went off. Now, that's not uncommon. It's been witnessed up where Timothy was and up at the McNeil River. And, you know, the working theory is big males, who are the biggest threat to your cubs, avoid human beings, and that's why they leave their cubs with them. This also happened to my daughter and me in Yellowstone Park 2 years ago. So, it's rarely witnessed outside of salmon stream. But anyway, Timothy, just lived right next to these bears and didn't have any fear of them. And way beyond that, he gave them all names, silly names, Goofy and Bouncy and whatever. And he thought, he really believed, in one of the last letters that he wrote, he believed he was brother to the bear, meaning that the bears recognized him as a friend and an ally. And, that's a very false assumption. You know, grizzly bears have their own agenda, and they don't prescribe to human, prescriptions for behavior. And Timothy, what happened when he and his girlfriend, who was the daughter of a man I know, they got killed and eaten by grizzlies in Katmai National Monument. Timothy went back too late. And I mean late. It was probably, I think it was October. And the salmon runs, that's when they end. And when the food source goes away, a lot of big male grizzlies come down and drive all the other bears away, including family groups. And that's what Timothy got into a fight with an airline desk. And stormed off and got back in the plane and went back to this remote beach in Katmai National Monument. And in the middle of a rainy night, he heard a grizzly trying to get into there. They had some food around. And this was not rare for Timothy. He went out to check out this grizzly. And, we have a lot of details in it, but, the bear did not run away like the others. It fought him and killed him, and eventually, the bears fed on Timothy's remains.
Right.
And, so it was, really tragic, but
extraordinarily unwise, if I can be polite about it. It doesn't, when I first heard the story back then, it just struck me as not good. Hey, we don't have a ton of time left. And I really wanted you to talk about climate change. I apologize. Climate change and the effect it has on grizzly bears in Yellowstone, which kind of got your latest project going in 2016, when I guess the Obama administration and then the Trump administration followed suit, wanted to delist the bears as endangered. So how does climate change affect the grizzly population up in Yellowstone, and then what happened?
Well, first of all, we're going to have California-style unstoppable fires, I believe, this summer. And when one of those fires hits Yellowstone, the forests tend to come back as grassland. That's already documented. Climate, you know, the climate has been warming since 2002, and that has allowed the pine bark beetle to move up a life zone. And the most important grizzly bear food in Yellowstone Park is the nut, the pine nut of the white bark pine tree. And with warming winter temperatures, the you know, the same bark beetle you've got in Colorado moved up a life zone, because white bark pine is like 8,000-9,000 feet. It's high altitude. And it killed 95% of all the mature cone-bearing white bark pine. And so the mountains around Yellowstone by, 14 years ago, they just turned red. And you could drive around Yellowstone, and it was first really dramatic example of climate change. Now, climate change is driven especially by polar activity. And there's some very bad news coming. It's possible we're going to lose all Arctic ice by the end of next summer, by September of 2022. And I don't know what that's going to do, but it is too terrifying. I have two children and now a grandchild, and it's scary for all of us. Climate change is going to hit us here. But its causation often happens, you know, and with an ice sheet in Antarctica breaking off, and like if the Ross ice sheet, a big unstable one, breaks loose, it's like, you know, a dozen feet of sea rise in a week. And the same for the Arctic ice, you know, up north, that polar ice. You know, once the ice is gone, the water absorbs all the heat that otherwise is reflected back by ice and snow. And you know, it's a feedback system. It's the biggest threat to grizzly bears and also Homo sapiens. We're all on that list, I'm afraid. So you know, the federal government didn't recognize climate change as having any effect on the grizzly, and I'm trying to change that as I go. You know, and my projects include an underpass of I-90, because grizzly bears have a hard time moving around. And with climate change, the habitat is going to get worse. You know, it's going to be less carrying capacity. Bears need to migrate if we want them around. And we need to, social tolerance by human beings is the key to letting grizzly bears, you know, recolonize new habitats.
Doug, unfortunately, we are just about out of time, and I apologize to Brian and the other callers. We didn't get to the phones, but you've provided a ton of information and some interesting history. Is there a way that listeners can learn more about you and your work, current projects with grizzlies, website, books? What do you have for us?
Yeah, I've got a website. I'm not much good at this stuff. I think it's just Doug Peacock .net, and also Save the Yellowstone Grizzly. We have a website there. I founded that organization because we took the government, you know, the federal court, and we won twice. And when they wanted to delist the grizzly, the federal courts decided the grizzly bear needs to stay on the endangered species list. I had a discussion with the new director of the Federal Wildlife Service a week ago, and there's hope there the first time in 30 years. At least they're trying to be on our side. And, I think a world with grizzly bears in it is an altogether better world.
Certainly. Hey, Doug, thank you so much for, you know, your candid responses to some sensitive stuff, and thank you so much for appearing today. We appreciate it. I wish we had more time.
Okay, Roger. Thank you for your consideration. Appreciate it.
Okay. That was Doug Peacock. You've been listening to Connections. I'm Roger Wendell. I want to thank Donna Lurie behind the scenes for handling the phones. It can be difficult at times. Up next is Meredith with the Morning Sound Alternative. Have a great day, and thanks for supporting KGNU.
Day after day, I'm more confused.